Welcome to the first episode of Disrupt, a home healthcare news podcast. I'm Tim Mullaney, the editor of Home Healthcare News. This episode of Disrupt is brought to you by Homecare Homebase, America's number one home health software solution. Homecare Homebase's powerful cloud-based home health software streamlines every aspect of your business, from scheduling, routing, and patient notes to billing, approvals, and more. Visit hchb.com and see how home health software can help your organization. And I'm very excited to be bringing you my conversation with Shelly Sun. She is the co-founder and CEO of Brightstar Care. She started Brightstar in 2002, and the company began franchising in 2005. Today, there are more than 300 franchises across the United States offering medical and non-medical home care. Brightstar Care also provides medical staffing. Shelly spoke with me about how she went from a high-achieving corporate finance and accounting executive to being an entrepreneur with a goal of creating what she calls the Neiman Marcus of home care. Shelly, welcome to the podcast. I'd like to start by just getting a sense of the road that you took to home care. So turning the clock back, I think that if I'm correct, you studied accounting at the University of Tennessee and then at the University of Colorado at Boulder for grad school. So wondering if you're sort of a, seems like you must be a finance or numbers person by nature, is that true? And can you take us back to that time in your life and sort of what you expected to do with those accounting degrees and maybe what your first jobs were out of school?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, coming out of school, you know, started in public accounting, as many do, and found that that just wasn't as interactive with large teams of people that I would aspire to be able to mentor and develop others. So left after a relatively short period of time and was really drawn to entrepreneurial startup companies in the early stage of my career. Being able to have the willingness I had to work long hours. I've always had a great work ethic. I started my first job at 15 and a half. I'd work as many hours as my mom and the school would allow me to work and still got straight A's. So I've always had a willingness and aptitude for work, and a startup gave me an opportunity to see large amounts of contribution have a very material impact, and being able to build wealth for the owners and create opportunities for the employees within an organization, very much from a finance and accounting path. But I started taking on larger and larger teams as I was recognized as someone who was willing to engage, give honest feedback, help develop people. And so that led me through several different growing stage organizations. Actually, before I moved to Chicago, was living in Colorado, as you noted, was working for Blue Cross Blue Shield, and had an opportunity to go through their transitions there, where I was asked to move into an operational role out of a finance role. Again, given the fact that I had an aptitude for numbers, meant that I could track key performance indicators for a large group. I had about 300 employees reporting to me through a downstream organization from an accountability perspective, and did an operational turnaround of the membership group in the Colorado Blue Cross Blue Shield plan. Had an opportunity to make a decision that the new owners of our business were just not culturally aligned with what I wanted to do or the path I wanted to go down. So worked with a recruiter and found a job with CNA Insurance in Chicago. Became their youngest vice president ever, running the SEC and government reporting areas, back into my accounting roots, but with a pretty large team, probably 25 to 30 people. Within a year, I was asked to take on the entire reinsurance area, and again, got back to managing hundreds of people and developing and augmenting that group with better metrics, better training, better accountability. Made a decision to go back to a startup in the aviation industry in late 2001, early 2002. Great opportunity, poor timing. It was right after September 11th. The funding was from United, and the unions interceded to say that funding had to be pulled from this entrepreneurial startup that was fractional jet ownership. And so I had been there for a handful of months, and they made a decision to shut down the organization. I didn't come from aviation, but I went to the executives at United and said, look, I haven't been here very long. I'm very independent in terms of coming in. I believe you've mispriced fuel. If I can recover the money that you have overpaid, could I extend my benefits in terms of severance? Because I would have only, based upon my time there being less than a year, only been eligible for 2 week severance. I negotiated if I could recover them at least $10 million, I would be entitled to a year's severance. During that same kind of 4 to 5 month period of time, I was the one tasked within the family to help select home care services for our grandmother who needed care at home, and she was in a different state. And so I got to see firsthand how there was this huge need for doing home care right with a high quality orientation that we weren't able to find. Hence, I understood there was a gap in the marketplace that I wish I could have paid more for and had a higher quality, higher service experience. I did recover the $10 million, actually $27 million for United. Got a year's severance, had a nest egg. That nest egg, as well as the passion and calling around the home care experience for my grandmother, allowed for kind of two things to meet and intersect at about the right time. I wound down at the United subsidiary in May of 2002, and Brightstar was launched October 1st, 2002.
Interesting. And I guess turning the clock even farther back, I am curious, you mentioned your first job, I think at 15, you said, what was that first job?
For those that know that I have a shoe fetish, they will not be surprised to know that was working in a shoe store. And I almost had to sign over my paycheck every 2 weeks just for the new shoes that I would want to buy. So.
Oh, that's really funny. So I do want to get back to the start of Brightstar and get a little more detail there. But before we get there, I have just a couple more questions
Sure. That
are a little more personal in nature, trying to get at what makes you tick a little bit. So it sounds like you have an interesting blend of skills in terms of sort of hard-nosed finance, being able to crunch the numbers, and just what you did with the fuel prices, I think demonstrates maybe your aptitude and skill set there. And then also maybe people skills in terms of being good at and interested in managing teams. So wondering if I'm sort of correct in saying that you have maybe both of those skill sets, and if you can maybe just more globally describe how you describe your leadership style generally.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think that I get a lot of energy from helping someone reach their potential. So whether that's an employee, whether that's creating peace of mind with an adult daughter, or that's enabling a franchisee to achieve levels of success, both in the rewards of making a difference in their clients' lives as well as financial success, those all bring me energy. They always have my entire career. So while I've always been, and had a very strong aptitude for numbers, it feels very rear view mirror, and I always wanted to make a difference. And so I have a huge aptitude around finance, but I think I've always looked for ways to apply that to making a difference in the future. People are our greatest asset in any organization. What I could do to develop up and help an employee reach their next level of potential, or now an employee and a franchisee reach their next level of potential, it is something that, because I'm so passionate about it and enjoy applying the time, I think I've gotten better with it over time. But it is where I get the greatest reward, our small groups, our individual ability to help employees reach their potential, and then being able to look out into the future and see where could we differentiate as a brand, how could we differentiate around the customer experience, what are the investments we need to make today to get there. I think those skill sets are very unusual for a tried and true accountant that tends to be very good at calculations and historical, but being able to say that was a skill set because I loved numbers. I didn't find passion in applying it to a historical reference, but have found a way I think employees reach potential when you give them very clear expectations, and those expectations should be as objective and therefore quantifiable as possible. So I've been able to take a acumen with numbers and find a utilization of them that actually feels like it does make a difference in helping people reach their potential, know their expectations, and charting that out with a quantitative set of expectations into the future, but also utilize that to try to cast a vision forward and feel good about risk-taking in terms of the investments that we should make today to realize a return in the future, but being balanced in that. So for me, what has served me well throughout 15 years as an entrepreneur is I'm, yes, trying to maximize profitability around the core business model, but I always am taking about 20% of the profits that has obviously grown as a pool of money as I've gotten bigger and intentionally invested in things, been willing to take bets in investing in things where I believe we're going to be 3 years out. So I'm not betting 100%, but I am taking calculated, targeted risks and investing in where I believe the industry or our brand can go.
And this is maybe skipping a little bit ahead to questions I have around staffing, but since you brought up tracking key performance indicators and being good at setting objective goals for people, I'm wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit on that, because it seems like in home care to me and healthcare generally, it's a tension in the industry that it's becoming more and more data-driven, more and more metrics are being used to evaluate success, things like readmissions, length of stay. And yet we also hear from clinicians that some of them feel like they're maybe quote-unquote soft skills of being caring for patients are becoming less valued. So wondering if that's something that you think about and encounter as a challenge, and how you, given that it seems like those KPIs have been important and a strength for you as a leader, if you also have strategies around some of those quote unquote softer skills and evaluating those of your workers.
Yeah, I think it's really important as we're thinking about the what the business is that our franchisees are in on a daily basis, delivering care for individuals through the utilization of healthcare employees and clinicians. I think there is a way and a necessity to measure quantitative in terms of outcomes and productivity, but there are ways to objectively also measure the qualitative in terms of patient satisfaction scores and looking at those net promoter scores for our consumers and for our adult daughters that are typically the ones arranging for care gives us a chance to make sure that those softer skills are being objectively measured while it's not just about a quantitative readmission reduction. It's also we want a happy and satisfied client who's also achieving great clinical outcomes. So I think if we're looking at patient satisfaction as well as looking at patient clinical outcomes, you married together have the best of both worlds. But I do believe you have to, at the end business model, look at both. Just like we have to look at productivity and compliance with our caregivers, but we also look at caregiver engagement score. And that is interacting with at least 10% of our workforce every single month to find out why they work for Brightstar, what we could be doing better, and doing something with that data to make it actionable so we are able to retain more of our caregivers with our brand and use it as a launch pad for recruiting additional to keep our brand growing. So I think there is a way to do qualitative and quantitative. I read a book about 4.5 years ago called entitled Traction, by Gino Wickman, and it lays out an entrepreneurial operating system that has served us so well, and it is about defining for the brand and then also at the franchisee level. The book doesn't teach you that, but I took the book's principles that I put in place for our corporate organization and built a franchisee-facing one. You build a scorecard. What are the top 10 KPIs that will inform the business model. And, you know, like in any balanced scorecard, some of that is around profitability, some of that's around revenue growth, some of that's around customer and caregiver experience. So again, getting at the hard and soft components of the business model, but through an objective measurement that you can trend with time to make sure you're improving all of them. So we have a set of 10 KPIs that are for the franchisor organization, if you will, and we have 10 KPIs that are at the franchisee unit level as well. And some of those, just those disciplines, and then prioritizing my people's time around a quarterly look around what is termed in the book rocks. What are the most critical items that if they accomplish those rocks, are the pebbles and sand really important? Or is it where we tend to spend our time versus the rocks? Mm-hmm. Working on those is really what's going to make the biggest impact. And so we use that to, and I use that with my team to help keep them laser focused on where we could make the biggest impact. And we don't start looking at the pebbles in the sand unless we're on track with getting our rocks accomplished. And so I think that that from a leadership perspective allows me to guide, but not micromanage. But we are aligned around what the rocks are that need to be accomplished each quarter. And we've rolled that out so franchisees are doing the same thing with their teams.
Got it. What's can you share an example of what one rock might be versus a pebble?
A rock might be building a technology interface with one of our national account partners to drive greater volume and greater margin, critical to the business model. A pebble might be going through a contract rate review with a national account partner.
So it sounds like prior to starting Brightstar, you worked for some very large organizations like I think Blue Cross Blue Shield, you said, and obviously a subsidiary of United. Oh, and then you also worked for some startups, I think. So
right.
I guess curious about your own entrepreneurial drive and whether you sort of always felt that, or is it something that you sort of discovered in working for these different types of organizations?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say in working with so many franchisees and knowing their story that led them to become a franchisee, most were unhappy in corporate America and felt unvalued. I didn't have that experience in corporate America. I actually enjoyed usually being one of the top performing employees and being able to find and gravitate my way to expanded roles to make a difference. So I wasn't necessarily seeking a path towards no longer being a corporate employee. And probably the same reason I have an outside board that I allow to beat me up, even though I own 100% of the stock now. I want to just be the best I can be. And I felt like the corporate structure allowed me to have a mechanism for feedback that my board does for me now. But the path came through a personal experience. And because no one else at the time that Brightstar was created had solved how do we help families that are going through the challenge of finding home care have a great experience with that, it was frustrating to me that I could pay more for a different seat on an airplane. I could pay more to have a different restaurant experience. I could pay more to shop at a Nordstrom's or Neiman Marcus versus, you know, another store that might not have the same kind of service or brands that I might want to interact with. But in healthcare, it really didn't matter that I was willing to spend more. Everything was kind of Walmart. And I like there just has to be a segment of the population that we're not going to be for everybody, but we're talking about people's moms and dads, grandmas and grandpas. If they had the ability to pay for that different airline seat, they certainly would be willing to spend more to have a company pay their employees to have the highest caliber people, the most trained, and have nurse oversight to do it in quote unquote the right way, the best way, if it wasn't commoditized and trying to just deliver the cheapest price. And since we couldn't find it, I just a natural curiosity about what if this was something that I could solve. Now, I only gave myself 1 year. If I couldn't be successful and be on a trend to replace what my earning capacity was as a corporate employee, I would go back to being a corporate employee because I didn't mind doing it. But I gave myself only 1 year to quote-unquote be successful. in this entrepreneurial venture that I had never undertaken before. So I guess even within my accounting roots, there was a risk I was willing to take, but there was a downside I wasn't willing to cross. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was a one-year time frame. Now, within 1 year, the business was doing over $1 million in revenue, and we were making a huge difference. My third month in, I wound up being able to help a wonderful man who has become a dear friend, who's a quadriplegic, didn't know him before he worked with Brightstar. But 3 years later, when I had preemie twins, my first gift while delivering twin boys at 28 weeks, my first gift was from that quadriplegic client, even before either of the grandparents had done something my quadriplegic client had. And so I had an honor to become very close with many families, and they became very close with me. So not only did we achieve $1 million of revenue, we changed lives, and I had my life changed. It meant that I said to someone maybe a year or 18 months after starting the business, they're like, so what do you think about going back to corporate America? I said, I'm completely unemployable now because this is so much fun, and I feel like I'm really making a difference. And while I had an impact in corporate America, not the kind of impact mm-hmm. like changing lives like I get to with Brightstar.
So that was 2002, is that right? That Brightstar was founded? Okay. If you can just talk me through the nuts and bolts a little bit of what that first year was like in terms of what the business model was like and how you managed to achieve that goal that you set yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So that first year, you know, even pre-opening, it was with, you know, meeting with, running ads and meeting with tons of certified nursing assistants and nurses to build up a bench of people who we could deploy out to families' homes once we started building a website, working on advertising, going out and talking to referral sources about who they used and what do they do to solve these needs for families. My first three clients, one came through a referral from a hospital, and I went out and met in the living room with John, their adult son. They had four boys, but the adult son that lived kind of here in the area, and Stanley and Ann were their husband and wife we were going to be taking care of. So my role was to both handle all of the administrative, if you will, of recruiting caregivers and interviewing them and onboarding them and paying them, but also kind of those client relations in terms of going out and meeting with the family before they decided to use us in their living room to help them have a feel for why I started the business and what we were going to deliver. Then I would matchmake them with all the caregivers that I knew. I'd schedule that out from a technology perspective, and then I'd pay the caregivers. I'd bill the client, and I'd follow back up with the caregiver and the client to make sure there was a good match and everything was proceeding as it should. My second client was a quadriplegic that came through a nurse postcard campaign that I did to nurses in Illinois for recruiting, and they had had problems with their existing agency. His wife happened to be a licensed practical nurse, saw the postcard, and they called to have me come interview to see if they would consider moving their case from another agency to me. And I went out, they had a Pomeranian Mabel, and I love dogs, and they said, oh, well, don't pick up Mabel, she's very, very fussy. And I said, oh, okay. And we sat there at the kitchen table, and Tim was kind of pulled up to the kitchen table, and we're sitting there and we're talking. And without kind of knowing it, like Mabel starts coming up to my leg, probably just they sense personality and things like that. And so she's sitting there in my lap, and I'm rubbing her belly as we're talking about being able to make a difference for them and how I would go about it. And I said, so, you know, what do you think the next steps are? He goes, Mabel already hired you. So that was my second client. So, you know, I mean, just, you know, kind of thinking those through, my third client came through an advertisement in a church bulletin, and they wound up calling the agency. I kind of pre-sold them over the phone and then went out and met mm-hmm. with them in the living room. So my role was very client-facing in the living room. I had a salesperson mm-hmm. who was going out, you know, calling on those referral sources to get the phone to ring. But I had to make families feel like we could do it to get the honor mm-hmm. of being in their living room, and then from there, matching them up with the caregivers that I had hired, and then all the administrative after that. So the reality was, you know, I'm meeting with families, you know, 7 to 9 a.m. and from 5 to 8 p.m. because they typically, the adult children were working. They wanted to meet with a company like ours before or after their work hours. I was recruiting, interviewing, scheduling, answering phones during the day, and I'd spend, 8 p.m. to midnight doing payroll billing, scheduling all of the technology, administrative paying bills, and all those kind of things. So, my first probably 3 to 4 years, I probably did not have a week that I worked under 90 hours a week and took 1.5 weeks of vacation in the second part of the second year. It was the first time I took a day off. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of, what you do as an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of that first year of being a brand new entrepreneur. And we had one location. And then I got a call to think about bidding on Chicago Public Schools and opening a Chicago location. So my second year, I opened a Chicago location. We had a large client who wanted services from us. They were living in an assisted living. The assisted living asked us to consider putting an office out in McHenry County. We opened a third location. I had an opportunity at the time to, which was in 2004, to invest in hotels. Went to new manager and new owner training with the hotels. That was a franchise model, and saw franchising from a franchisee's perspective. Before I ever franchised my business, I saw it from a franchisee lens. Like, mm-hmm. We totally could franchise this. We totally could be of huge value to a franchisee, as my hotel brand is to me, not knowing anything about the hotel industry. And so that led to 2005, 2006, launching the brand into a franchise. And had we not franchised Bright Star, we probably would still be 3 locations instead of 325.
Right. So where did the capital come from to start the business? Did you put it up yourself? Did you have investors?
I have never had investors. I own 100% of the stock still today. So my severance nest egg from United was a lot of the capital, because we were able to go in with, $150,000 of liquidity of our own to start the business. I was able to get small business, women-owned business financing on an SBA program that gave me, when we started a franchise, $250,000 of a loan, and allowed me in the very beginning to access a line of credit secured against my receivables. That's the only debt that we took on until probably our 5th to 6th year in business for projects, but the company was already profitable by that point in time, so it was easy for a lender just to secure against the, kind of the assets of the business and a personal guarantee. And then beginning in 2015, was able to get my personal guarantee off. We still have debt involved with the business, but all the equity is owned by me.
And so I think it was in 2005 that you started franchising, is that right?
Yeah, we did all the legal work and filings and compliance in 2005, wrote the operations manuals in 2005. We opened our first franchise unit in March of 2006.
So it was just a year or maybe 2 years later that the financial crisis hit. But if the data I have is correct me if it's not, but I think that Brightstar grew from about 50 locations to almost 250 locations between 2008 and 2011. So wondering if you can sort of talk about how you managed to grow the company in such a tough economy.
Yeah, I mean, we had substantial growth. I don't know if it was quite 250, but we had substantial growth during that period of time. We probably grew to opened number of locations between 150 and 200 at that point in time. I think by 2013, 2014, we were probably up over the 250 mark and 325 today. But during that period of economic crisis, I think what people still had were home values, and they tended to have 401k balances and financing vehicles for helping people who were getting downsized. Because what you saw were a lot of very competent executives losing their jobs. They had 401ks, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 in their 401ks. Some of them still had home equity. And you had home equity lines being approved higher than they had been. So 2008 to 2012, 401ks as a source of investing in a business, the tax laws allowed you to put it into a business and not have it count towards taxes. So you weren't having to you know, cash it out to make an investment in the business. You could roll it into your own business versus roll it into a mutual fund. So you had a lot of people utilizing their 401k, having a belief in themselves, not knowing when the next corporate job was going to come at that executive level, because a lot of those went away, some of which have still not come back. Mm-hmm. And it created a path for folks needing to do something, having them resources and a mechanism with 401k rollovers to start their own journey as an entrepreneur.
That's interesting. So in a sense, it maybe helped. There was this pool of highly qualified executives.
Yeah, because if unemployment had always stayed 3-4% and you hadn't had displaced executives, franchising wouldn't have grown during that period of time. Mm-hmm. And while there was a financial crisis and unemployment significantly increased, arguably those have been, over the last 10 years, the best years of franchising. When unemployment low, franchising usually doesn't grow as quickly as when unemployment is high and mm-hmm. and growing.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other piece of that is the consumer demand, because, and this might be a good opportunity to hear a little bit more about what you were referencing earlier, which is the sort of Neiman Marcus of home care model that Brightstar was taking on to provide a higher level of care for a higher price point. I think one piece of that is, for instance, having a registered nurse on every case. Can you sort of talk through what that means, that sort of Neiman Marcus level of care means, and the sort of what the consumer profile is for Brightstar?
Yeah, certainly. So our brand commitments are to handle every patient, every family, as though they were our own. So it means that we are sending out people that have been in-person interviewed. References have been verified. They've passed competency testing, behavioral testing. They've done background check, drug screen, all of that, so that we know that they are qualified to perform care, matching carefully with a client. But then, as you know, we're one of the only brands who does two things. One has a registered nurse as the director of nursing in every single one of our locations across the country. Secondly, offer the full continuum of care. So we're offering non-medical and medical care. They might not need medical care when they first start, but knowing that they won't have to change from one agency to another when they do need medical care allows us to be a part of the family's life and have them have confidence that we're going to be a part of that journey during their parents' lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so that's really unique to us. When we first started, we've always had the registered nurse. We've always had the full continuum of care. As we've expanded as a franchise brand, we have kind of taken that to other levels as to how can we make sure that those brand standards are at the highest level, that we deliver that, you know, Neiman Marcus level of quality and service experience. And so we aligned with the Joint Commission that accredits most of the hospitals and nursing homes in the country to accredit our home care agencies. Out of over 28,000 agencies in the United States, we are the only brand to achieve Joint Commission's Enterprise for Champion quality designation, and we've achieved it 6 years in a row. The other two brands that have that same distinction for 5 years or longer is Cleveland Clinic and Mayo. So we're in good company. We don't just say we're a high-quality organization. We believe we have to back that up with a third-party verification that we're operating at those standards. That makes me sleep good at night knowing that all of my franchisees are having to go through that process and having to be verified as meeting those standards, because their consumers are the same moms and dads I always desire to take care of and make a difference in their lives.
And just to clarify, the skilled care components that you offer is also private pay. It's not Medicare. You're not Medicare certified.
We're not Medicare certified. Now, we do take commercial insurance. So some of our skilled business for those under the age of 65 may be reimbursed by commercial insurance or workers' comp.
On the insurance question, I don't know if you saw this. It's a new announcement and details are scarce, but CMS announced that non-skilled personal care services are going to start.
It hasn't been approved yet.
Yes. Has not been approved yet. Yeah. Right. Just wondering what you make of that announcement, if that is something that is of interest, concern to you if you're in
not, waiting? Not concern. We have third party relationships with insurance companies now that use some Medicare home health agencies that don't have the bandwidth to do these services on a basis to not know what their volume is going to be day to day, where we supplement from a staffing perspective, they bill Medicare. So we don't see downward trends. Might it for our largest franchisees that are the most capitalized cause us to allow them to have a exception to be able to go for Medicare certification and take Medicare reimbursement, you know, just like we have a model simplification where we stage out franchisees based upon revenue growth with intentionality as to what do they start with and then what do we add to keep helping them grow revenue as well as profitability with time. Does it add a sixth dimension? Right now we have six stages of revenue. Might there be five stages of revenue, might there be a sixth that is focused on Medicare under certain conditions? So we'll see if it gets passed. Medicare is still bankrupt and isn't appropriately funded for the foreseeable future. So we'll see if that gets passed and is supported with the budget to do so. But yes, we did absolutely see that announcement. Also did research the announcement that it wasn't passed, but are keeping our eye on it.
So curious about sort of the affordability of senior care. I think you've had success with this Neiman Marcus model going after maybe a higher price point consumer. But, something we report on a lot is that there's this big middle income market of aging adults in the United States. And wondering if you see that middle income opportunity, if that's something that you're interested in, or if you really think that you've got a model that works and going forward, you're going to stick with that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that we are outside of the range of affordability for middle-income families. I mean, I would say while the dollars are different on a daily basis depending on the hours of care, it's a difference of whether you go to Starbucks for your coffee or Dunkin' Donuts. You're still going and spending discretionary money for coffee. In our case, you're still spending discretionary money for care. We are not double. We have the same margins relatively as our competitors. The difference is we pay our employees so that we keep them and retain them and can have access to enough of them and the most qualified. And we have an experience requirement. They have to meet certain hurdles and certain standards. I wouldn't want anything different, nor would I sacrifice having to move downstream to less qualified labor so that I could help reach more consumers but not feel good about what they might be getting and not sleeping well at night and how we might be able to execute. I think when you're talking about people's care, certified nursing assistants are not trained to be able to recognize a change in condition. So they need access to a nurse to make sure we prevent unavoidable medical incidents. I wouldn't want to do a model that had to move downstream and I couldn't help avoid a hospitalization or a death with a certified nursing assistant where that's my only labor. And so could I deliver care $4 to $5 cheaper by not having registered nurses and having someone who's a brand new grad who's never seen what it's like to interact with a dementia patient and how to help them through those scary, highly anxious moments during their journey? I wouldn't choose to sacrifice the quality that we deliver, which we believe is appropriate, to go capture a portion of the market that might only be able to afford $5 less per hour. We're not, you know, like I said, we're not charging double. It is a discretionary decision moving upstream. I'd rather see a family utilizing, you know, us for 5 hours a day versus a competitor at 8 hours a day that's the same dollars per day, or we still have a registered nurse at least, checking in there and our caregivers taking notes. And so if there's a change in condition during that 5 hour period, we're going to know it if we need to intercede in some way versus never knowing it until a family member is there for most of our competition. And then working with a family to use a monitoring device for the other hours that we're not there. I think that's how we have to help families augment what they can afford with how do you still make sure they have a high quality experience with what they can afford. And I think it's a combination of the most number of hours they can afford with BrightStar and a monitoring dimension that post hospital stay, all of the hospitals, you know, can put those mechanisms in place. And so to me, it's not a trade-off of if BrightStar or someone else, or if BrightStar high end versus middle, where it might not be, it wouldn't anticipate change in condition in a preventative way. It's how many hours can a family utilize of high quality care. If I was a limited resource, and I was, you know, back when I was in corporate America, a limited resourced adult child trying to make care decisions, there are a certain number of hours of care per day that I could afford. I would rather have had fewer hours of a high quality experience that involved a nurse than lower hours of a companion with no oversight that is a babysitter but isn't going to be able to help detect if there's a medical intervention that's necessary.
And you brought up the monitoring technology, so I just wanted to get your thoughts on technology in general and how it might be changing the game for home care. Monitoring is obviously a big piece of it, and you've sort of already described the role that can play. But I know that BrightStar has made big investments in technology and is developing platforms in-house. So wondering if you can maybe briefly describe what some of those tech initiatives are and why the decision to not just go with off-the-shelf solutions.
Well, when we started, there weren't off-the-shelf, but we've rebuilt the technology to be, you know, latest code twice since from the ground up. We've made that decision because we didn't find anything off-the-shelf that handled our full array of businesses. We do home care non-skilled, we do home care skilled, and we do staffing. So not one solution that does all three. We also recognize as a franchisor, we have a significant national account portfolio that none of our competitors have. And if I was using it off the shelf, as I create those programs for my national account partners, I would have to tell these national computer companies what to change to allow me to service my national account partner. And two of the largest have significant relationships, if not ownership, by the large national home care chains that are not us. So I'm not going to risk my franchisee's profitability and scalability by using an off-the-shelf software where I can't customize it as quickly as I want to, and those customizations wouldn't be proprietary, and there's ownership or board seats by my competitors on those technology companies where they're going to be aware of the proprietary investments and relationships that we have. So that would be why I wouldn't consider an off-the-shelf. The investments that we've made have been heavily around mobile. So all of our caregivers, we know from a GPS tracking that they're at a family's home, that they have arrived on time. If not, we have intervention quickly. They know what tasks to complete and weight, blood pressure, certain medical diagnostics that they should be taking each day and entering those in. If there are exceptions for change in condition, while a caregiver might not know it, it will go into our director of nursing's exception queue that she needs to have an intervention with the family and get the physician potentially engaged, and so we can be proactive, not reactive. All of that data is feeding our system so that we can look at outcomes based for certain things that we do, protocols that we follow. Is that having an influence on improving qualities of life? Allows us to A/B test changes in clinical protocols to see if it has an improved result in patient outcomes. We also have built into our technology where all of our nurses, while they're sitting with the family and doing an assessment, it would automatically populate. They might change it slightly, but it would automatically populate a care plan that then is setting up a standard set of protocols for our caregivers to follow. Protocols is what allows us to capture data so that we can then track our outcomes based upon a set of protocols that we have implemented at a point in time, and to be able to compare as we progress protocols or adapt protocols with time to see how those augment the quality outcomes for our patients, but also the reduction of the cost expenditures for the insurance companies that we work with.
Great. And then I know we're running up to our time here, but definitely want to touch on staffing and workforce issues since that's so top of mind and such a big concern for so many providers. And I know that's another area where you've made a significant investment. I think you've got an $800,000 strategy to sort of build up your credential caregiving staff. So I'm wondering if you can provide a little bit of description of what you're doing on that front.
Yeah, I mean, I think access to labor is certainly a both short-term and long-term challenge. I think the fact that we are positioned at a higher price point, we have done that from the very beginning so that we could afford the highest quality, most experienced caregivers, because caregiver match and their interaction with the family is what's going to drive the satisfaction of the client on a daily basis. So the fact that we're already positioned as that that top quartile of value in terms of the qualifications of the caregiver with what's delivered to the client allows us to pay a little upstream from our competition that is differentiating based upon price. When you differentiate based upon price, you have to pay the lowest wages to be able to do that. We don't differentiate on price. We differentiate on quality and service, so it allows us to pay a little upstream. That is a mechanism in the short term to have greater access to labor than our competition. Longer term, the average age of a nurse is over the age of 50. Caregivers are not entering the caregiving field as quickly as what the rate of new clients demanding care is. So you're going to have a gap, even if we can move them from some of our competition. There's going to be a gap holistically at a macro level. And so, yes, we are investing 3-year strategy to develop our own curriculum and then get them accredited with the states to develop up our own workforce of healthcare talent that we would then have an ability to influence the brand standards that they would follow, how they've been credentialed, what they've been trained, to make sure that they are experienced in the customer populations that we service, to arguably be better trained at a higher level than what we might be able to get from those that are training our workforce today if we were able to influence how they're trained based upon what we believe is important.
All right. Well, to wrap up, I just want to touch on two maybe more lighthearted things. One is your appearance on Undercover Boss. I can't not bring that up. That was back in 2011. You went on the show, and I think you were in a couple of different settings. I think you were a CNA at a facility, caregiver for quadruplets on the pediatric side, and LPN on an in-home visit. So just wondering, was that fun? Was it scary to go on the show? Why did you decide to do it?
Fun is not a word that comes to mind. rewarding. Okay. And the reason I chose to do it, and it was a huge risk, right? I mean, because I had to believe that all of my agencies across the country were operating at absolutely the highest standard, because I didn't get to choose which location they went to or which caregivers they interacted with. That was completely at the discretion of the network. I had to literally give them a list of my franchisees and the locations, and they chose. I had no editing rights. I saw the show live the same time you did. If you watched it live when it aired, I had no pre-editing rights. So my franchisees and I saw it exactly the same time, which is in some ways terrifying to not know what I was going to experience, but having to believe very strongly that we have great standards, we have directors of nursing overseeing everything at every agency. We were in the process of rolling out joint commission across the country. So I had to believe that the standards were going to be high. And if the standards were high, therefore it would show how great our brand was and expose our brand in a way we never could have afforded national advertising at that stage of time, but would give us exposure from a national perspective. I think 10 million people saw it, and since, hundreds of millions have seen it through replays and around the world. And so I think that was just such a unique opportunity. We had to go for it. If you believe in your brand, you'd have to go for it. It was 12, 20-hour days where they had filming even in my bedroom. So you didn't have a moment of privacy. So that's why I would say not fun. You were exhausted. I mean, absolutely. It was kind of brought me back to my first year of startup days of trying to keep up the pace of being on that many hours. But once I had filmed, I never worried about the episode airing because I didn't have any service issues that we couldn't learn from, or I didn't have one caregiver I wouldn't have had come in and take care of my twin boys or take care of my mom. And once I knew that, the humbling experiences of me not knowing how to change a poopy diaper, you know, was, you know, all in good fun. And there were some that didn't make the episode about, you know, other, you know, kind of things that I might not have known how to do, like turn on a vacuum cleaner. the things I'd always outsourced or had hardwood
right.
floors were somewhat comical, but the care that I got to see our caregivers and nurses provide was extraordinary and was what I would have expected and hoped for when I launched out to have a national brand that, you know, started on its foundation to take care of grandmas and grandpas, moms and dads. So with that, I would absolutely do it again. It was a great boost for our brand in terms of exposure and the number of new families we had the honor to take care of. People still talk about it today. Not just you, but I mean, people will be like, oh, Shelly, the episode is replayed, and we'll get hundreds of calls every single time that it replays. And that's so much fun being able to experience it, not in the moment of filming, but afterwards getting to enjoy pride in my franchisees, pride in our caregivers, pride in the brand we've had the honor to build and grow by taking care of families over the last 15 years.
Great. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity, Tim. I appreciate it.